From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
When he gets really vexed and annoying, I pull him up by his armpits, switch on the light in his cabinet, and, you know, he just goes into a comatose condition, which shuts him up, and he's getting to look at beautiful things.
Children's book author and illustrator Maurice Sendak, talking about one of his collections and the powerful impact that it has on a certain child. We'll hear more from Sendak in this hour as we present our collected thoughts on collecting.
A collection is a remarkable thing because it is a little universe that is ordered and that you can master. Maybe you can't master your life. You certainly can't master international politics. You can't even master the traffic in your city. But there in this room is stuff where you can say, this is important, this is valuable, this I'll throw out.
Also, the strange story of New York's greatest hoarders, the Collier Brothers. And we'll find out what musician Steve Naive does with the sounds he collects from hotel room windows around the world. But first, remember records? Those pieces of vinyl we used to spin when we wanted to listen to music? You think that nobody cares anymore about records? Well, think again.
Some records I will pay serious money for, provided that they're a sincere B+. Other than that, I just prefer to have them on CD.
But CDs will never have the presence of an original 78.
Wrong! A digital transfer adequately mastered will sound identical to the original. Do you have a decent equalizer?
I have a Klipsch 2B3.
Well, obviously the problem. You expect a 10-band equalizer to impart state-of-the-art sound? Dream a little dream. It's never going to happen.
It's a clip from the movie Ghost World. And those are the kind of people that Brett Milano writes about in his book Vinyl Junkies, Adventures in Record Collecting. Milano told Steve Paulson why some people are so obsessed with records.
A lot of music collectors, music lovers, do have a good supply of CDs. But to them, a CD is kind of, it's more like a representation of the object than it is the object itself. I mean, as someone in the book says, that the object is to get as close to the original event as possible. I mean, the event being that performance in the studio and how it was pressed into vinyl back at that very time. And if you can get the original pressing of a great record, whether it's, you know, Miles Davis or whether it's a 60s garage rock single, and getting it the way it was, just as it was originally pressed at that time, and getting a needle onto that, well, for these people, will just bring you back to that little island, that place where that music was made, and transport you there. And that's kind of the object of the search.
And do you think it really sounds different if it's on vinyl rather than CD?
Oh, it does. There's a guy in the book named Jeff Connolly who plays in a great Boston rock and roll band called The Liars. And he played me a record by a Chicago band called We the People, who made a couple of ultra, ultra obscure 60s garage rock singles, one of which was called You Burn Me Up and Down, which is kind of like, it's Louie Louie to the nth degree. I mean, it's ultra primitive, it's primal, it's great. And I'd heard the song a million times on CD reissues and bootleg vinyl reissues. He showed me the original single, which is has a beautiful white label, and he put it down on the turntable, and bam, I mean, this thing was just more vivid than I'd ever heard it before.
So it just sounds better. It sounds, what, brighter or warmer or what?
Brighter and warmer, I think, is a good start. There are kind of psychoacoustical reasons for this. I mean, I have talked to people like, say, Bill Englund, who works for Rhino Records and is one of the premier remasterers for CD. So CDs are really his bread and butter. But he will say that the physical act of dragging a little piece of rock against that piece of vinyl just creates certain resonant vibrations that you cannot get by pressing a button on a CD. Of course, you got to be pretty far gone to think that, but a lot of us are.
You write a fair amount about this guy, Jeff Connolly, who I guess goes by the name
Monoman.
Monoman, yeah. And he's pretty obsessive himself as a collector.
He's a great example of the sort of primal drive to get your hands on these records. I mean, I've been a fan of his music for a while, but he's somebody I know and someone that to me just embodied the mania that would make you want to get your hands and need to get your hands on these records. And it's the kind of the same mania that drives him to play music. Kind of a recurring thing. I mean, a lot of people in the book are musicians, people like Peter Buck from R.E.M. and Thurston Moore from Sonic Youth. And in a way, the same creativity they apply to their own music is applied to absorbing other people's music and absorbing records.
Now, does Mono Men have any particular stories about a few records that he has pursued endlessly?
There was one that he pursued almost literally endlessly. There was a guy named Tony Jackson, who was the original lead singer of The Searchers, the British invasion band. He was kicked out of The Searchers right before they made their big hit with Needles and Pins. But the records he sang on after he got kicked out of The Searchers were very pure, bluesy, British invasion rock and roll. And he had to get a certain EP that Tony Jackson made. And he found a collector in England that had that record. And he put money in the mail. The dealer wanted $2,000 for it. So what did he do? He took $2,000 of cash and sent it off to Europe to get a hold of this record. Did it get there? No. And so after going through a great existential crisis of what it all meant and what was he going to do with himself now, he ponied up another $2,000 and got it through PayPal. So there were four songs on that record. He did wind up paying a grand per song. Mind you, for songs he already had on a reissue CD. But
wait,
he already had it?
And
he had the songs. No, he wanted the original copy. He had them dubbed onto a CD, but he didn't want the CD. He wanted the vinyl.
Now, you have some great stories about obsessed collectors, and one of those is Robert Crumb, the legendary underground comics artist, and I guess he has a thing for old 78s.
Yeah, Robert Crumb's favorite music is very early jazz and blues. I mean, for him, there's just something very pure and inspiring about it. And he was one of those people that went around the country in the 70s knocking on doors. I mean, going into black neighborhoods where they had relatives that worked at the pressing plants, trying to find the original 78s. And he did wind up with a pretty good collection of them. His friend Terry Zweigoff, who directed Ghost World, was part of those expeditions. They found a lot of stuff together, and Crumb talks about that in the book. And in fact, Robert Crumb has only got a few hundred 78s. He's got, you know, maybe like 1,000 or so songs in his collection. So that's something you can maybe hope to absorb in your lifetime, and he's pretty happy with what he's got. But he'll say that even for him, like finding, you know, an original Charlie Patton record, he talks about working for some publisher he worked with when he was starting to do comics, and he sat the publisher down and played him a Charlie Patton 78, and the guy sat there and just didn't get it, and Crumb knew right away he did not want to work with this guy.
Now, I remember there was that documentary about Robert Crumb. I guess it was done by Terry Zweigoff, and as I recall, this whole business of record collecting kind of came up in that.
When I listen to old music, that's one of the few times when I actually have a kind of a love for humanity. You hear the best part of the soul of the common people, you know, their way of expressing their connection to eternity, or whatever you want to call it. Modern music doesn't have that calamitous loss that people can't express themselves that way anymore, you know.
Across the ridge may feel, and if I don't bring you flowers,
can see in that movie Crumb's collection of 78s and how painstakingly he had to package each of them up to get them across, because he moved to the south of France, so to get them across the Atlantic Ocean with him. And in fact, I asked him, he succeeded. He did not break any records on that trip.
What does R. Crumb think about his fellow record collectors?
Well, he says that record collecting is scary. And he says that it will not get you any action with the women, which for Crumb is a real horrible thing to say. And he's also very particular about what kind of music you collect. Robert Crumb, of course, did the cover for Cheap Thrills, the great Janis Joplin, Big Brother, and the Holding Company album. So I mentioned to him that, yes, I really like 60s psychedelic music. And that nearly ended the interview. His response was, oh, that's the worst kind of music ever made. And I said, okay, I won't go any further with that one.
Now, one thing that struck me is that I think everyone you've mentioned so far is a man. Are men just more obsessed about collecting records than women?
It does kind of seem that way, although I did try to refute the stereotype by getting some women collectors into the mix. There are women that do go out and collect records. I mean, there's a woman named Lisa Sutton in the book that's a big fan and enthusiast of 60s and 70s commercial pop bubblegum music. She's got more Partridge Family records than anybody and can tell you why they're so great. There is kind of an impulse. Maybe it's just more of an anal thing, and maybe that women experience life in a different way. I did talk to a woman in the book, a writer named Pagan Kennedy, who decided that collecting the records didn't have anything to do with the thrill that she got from hearing the music, which makes perfect sense logically. And maybe for us guys, logic doesn't really enter into it that way.
Is there anything in particular that these people have in common? I mean, maybe we've already talked about this, but I mean, other than sort of the quest to get close to the source, any other common traits?
One thing they all have in common, I think, is Pet Sounds by the Beach Boys. I don't think there's any collector that hasn't got that in their life somewhere. Other than that, I think it's a certain drivenness. It's a creativity. It's a willingness to fight against the boundaries, I suppose, of how much you can own, how much you can listen to, how much there is still out there to discover. I think these people were the overly good students that just had too much information at their disposal and keep wanting more.
So what do you have in your collection?
Mine just gets more eclectic by the day. Since I've written this book, I keep finding more stuff I just need to accumulate. My current passion is Moog synthesizer records from the early 70s, because those got pretty exotic after Switched On Bach became popular. There just became infinite knockoffs of that record. There was one called Everything You Always Wanted to Hear on the Moog But Were Afraid to Ask For, which is very over-the-top electronic versions of classical chestnuts. And then you get lots of songs played on the synthesizer that never should have audited that, like Raindrops Keep Falling My Head, played on a Moog. It's awful and it's perfect.
Brett Milano is the author of Vinyl Junkies, Adventures in Record Collecting. He spoke with Steve Paulson. The celebrated children's book author and illustrator Maurice Sendak once said that there must be more to life than having everything, which is somewhat ironic considering that Sendak has quite a few prized collectibles, including some letters that Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart wrote to his family, and some first-edition books by Herman Melville. Sendak told Steve Paulson about one of his great collections.
Mickey Mouse. I have one of the best collections of Mickey Mouse toys and books. He was my hero. We were born the same year, 1928, I am 2 months older than him. He looks 100 years younger than me. He's had a colossal career. And he gave me great, great pleasure as a child. And I went to the movies. There was always a double feature. And there was a cartoon in the middle. And I went with my sister. And she always warned me not to carry on. because when the cartoon began, you saw this enormous head of Mickey like the sun god, and beams were radiating out of his head in all directions. And I would start screaming like a maniac. I would start screaming. It's like I saw a vision of God, and he looked like Mickey Mouse. Who would have known?
So what kind of Mickey stuff do you have in your house?
Stuff from early Mickey, stuff from my childhood, stuff from the very early 30s. All the work, all the commercial stuff, junk, whatever, was made at the early time was stunning. It was tin and wood and material that was so lovely to feel, and the colors were so sensational. And you have Mickeys done in England that are much more beautiful than Mickeys done in America. And then French Mickeys are completely different and more beautiful. And every country, and somehow craftsmanship, toys in those days, I don't understand it. It's all pre-war. And then it all fell away. It all fell away. And by, the late 30s, Mickey had pretty much sold out. You know, he was putting on weight. He wasn't funny anymore. And my collection goes to about 1935 or possibly 6, because after that, he's just a Hollywood loser. Hmm.
So what do you do with a collection like this? I mean, do you have a room dedicated to Mickey Mouse?
I have closets filled with them. Everyone thinks I'm out of my mind, which, of course, who cares? I am. I still love them like I did. You know, we have a kid in the house who, he's not my kid, somebody's kid, who, when he gets really vexed and annoying, I pull him up by his armpits, switch on the light in his cabinet, and, you know, he just goes into a comatose condition, which shuts him up, and he's getting to look at beautiful things. I mean, it's enchanting to turn on the light, and you see these Mickey things glittering, and the colors are so vivid, and you see Mickey as he used to be with teeth. He was savage. He was brutal to Minnie.
What does this collecting impulse do for you? I mean, to be able to have this repository of treasures. The few things that you really love.
It's all for the same purpose, to inspire me, to turn me on, to get me to do something special. I always want to do something special. And all these things are special. Mickey in its own curious way, and Mozart in his own curious way. And notice the initials Mickey, Mozart, Maurice. I don't want to make much of that, but there it is. I steal from these things. These are all the things I take from. I take from what I read. I buy pictures and prints all the time. But they're all like homework. They're all things that I feel as though I need. And if I examine them carefully and study them very, very carefully, I will find something that I can take from them, some little bit, and turn them into some bit of a thing that suits me. So whether I do that or not, actually, I cannot swear to, but by having them around, the potential for doing it is enormous. You're surrounded by the great people of the world. You're surrounded by geniuses. And geniuses, you take from them.
Maurice Sendak is an acclaimed children's book author and illustrator. He spoke with Steve Paulson. You know, if you have questions or comments about the program, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us email through our website at www.ttbook.org. Coming up, more of our collected thoughts about the fine art of collecting, including this tidbit from William Randolph Hearst.
He was acutely afraid of death, so much so that when a tree died on the grounds in his fairy tale castle, the gardeners would either paint it or remove it and replace it before he realized, because otherwise he would throw a terrible fit.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Philip Blom is the author of a book called To Have and To Hold, An Intimate History of Collectors and Collecting. Blom told Anne Strainchamps about the history of collecting holy relics.
There was a large trade in holy relics, and to some extent there's still today. And of course in the Middle Ages the big problem was that when you got the bleached bones of Saint so-and-so, there was no way of telling whether those were the bleached bones of a saint or of a robber or of a Saracen or of a double murderer. They all look the same. And so people have done calculations of how many thigh bones of a particular saint there in Europe, and it's usually something like 16. I think John the Baptist has at least two heads and five arms or so. One thing that is important about holy relics is that I think holy relics give you an immediate in into what collecting really is all about and why collectors don't use the things that they have. Think of someone who collects rock star memorabilia and who's got a T-shirt that Mick Jagger wore in 1960-something, or, you know, the shoes that Paul McCartney was seen in on a London stage or something like that. Now, those are relics. Those are secular relics. Think of someone who's got Abraham Lincoln's autograph. That's a holy relic because it connects you to him.
Is that the thing we're looking for, the connection to somebody who's gone or who will never be connected to us in real life?
I think it's the connection to something that we are looking for, the connection to something we aspire to, we love, we want to be like. And I think that is very important for collectors. You know, a collection is a remarkable thing because it is a little universe that is ordered and that you can master. Maybe you can't master your life. You certainly can't master international politics. You can't even master the traffic in your city. But there in this room is stuff where you can say, this is important, this is valuable, this I'll throw out. This is my most precious piece. I will arrange them in this kind of hierarchy. And there you are the master of the world. And so this idea that it is a connection to a kind of better world, which is ordered, which is beautiful, which has genius, which has all sorts of things that you really want. Perhaps the world is in the past, perhaps it is still in the present, but it is anyway something that you want to have a connection with, just like Catholic people want, through a relic, have a connection to holiness, have a connection to God, because they believe that if you pray in front of a relic, the prayer is more efficacious. So I think their holy relics show you the nature of collected objects.
What about if you move forward in history and move into, say, American collectors and some of the great ones, the great millionaire collectors like William Randolph Hearst, for instance, the newspaper tycoon. What sort of collector was he?
Well, I mean, William Randolph Hearst was one of these people who really want to dominate the world. He played a deciding part in two American presidential elections. Nowadays, the idea that media play a deciding part in presidential elections isn't all that astonishing. Back then, it was really novelty. He also actually started a war, or got his government to start a war. He was someone who wanted mastery. He wanted to possess everything. Now, of course, you can't possess everything, but he had a crack at it. He bought things. He had a fabulous income. In today's terms, it would be, I think, something like $500 million a year. And he managed to spend it all, and he managed to get terribly in debt. Because he bought things. Now, there's something. There's two kinds of collectors that you can often see. That's why this book is called To Have and To Hold, because there are people who want to conquer, who want to have this moment of getting something and have this great pleasure, and then they almost lose interest in it. And there are people who want to possess something, who want to know it's theirs and nobody else's. Now, that was what Randolph William Hearst was doing.
In other words, there are people who collect for love and there are people who collect for power.
In a way, yes. Hearst had things that he ordered by catalogue or he saw in a shop or something like that, and he bought it and had it straight shipped to his magazines. And he never saw the stuff again. It was stocked. There were thousands of cases containing entire parts of buildings, but also works of art and armour and furniture. Hearst also had a whole huge herd of cattle. He had, of course, cars, but also aeroplanes. He had an enormous zoo, and he was somebody, and that is also another thing that I think is significant about Collector, he was acutely afraid of death. So much so that when a tree died on the grounds in his fairy tale castle, the gardeners would either paint it or remove it and replace it before he realized, because otherwise he would throw a terrible fit. If one of his associates died, he would send his lawyers to the funeral. He wanted to have nothing to do with death.
Do you think this is true of many collectors, that drive to acquire is about staving off the fear of death?
Well, you know, if you think of the grave of a pharaoh, it contains a little symbolic world. And that little symbolic world is supposed to serve the pharaoh to live beyond his life, to live in another world.
What about today? Have we become a society of collectors?
It is very interesting today because collecting was revolutionized at the beginning of the 20th century quite simply because mass-produced objects became so much more readily available. It meant that you no longer had to be a rich bourgeois or a nobleman to acquire an interesting collection, but you could be a nobody. And you could find cigarette cards very interesting, or bits of porcelain, or anything that was basically didn't cost a lot of money. Matchboxes, something like that. But I think today there's a trend that I find very interesting because, of course, we live in a hugely standardized world. And we live in a world where everything becomes the victim of marketing. And today there are collector's editions of things. That means there are things that are no longer even supposed to enter into the stream of consumption or use, but that just skip that moment altogether and are just put into collector's cupboards straight away.
So we're producing the collectibles.
Yes, but also, of course, 30 years ago there was something like a big youth rebellion movement, and people wore torn clothes and had long hair just to show the older generation that they weren't like them. Today you can buy this all off the peg. You buy your torn designer jeans and you go to a fashionable hairdresser to have your hair long, and you buy the music that goes with it, the magazines that go with it, and you think you're making a gesture of protest, but actually you're just being a good little consumer. Now, some collectors have found an intelligent response to that by looking for oddities because, you know, the great challenge in our world is to maintain our individuality. To not just be another Ralph Lauren kind of guy or another Tommy Hilfiger kind of kid, but to become you or me or somebody who cannot just be interchanged with somebody else in those clothes. So some collectors now, they look for books that has the page 16 three times in them, or they look for a line of dolls that Barbie put out once but that didn't work, and that was pulled from the market very quickly. They look for oddities. They look for the cracks in the perfect consumer utopia. And I find that very interesting because it seems to me to be an intelligent response to the world we're living in.
But it's just like King Rudolph or Peter the Great. They're still looking for the one-of-a-kind object.
Yes, they're still looking to assert their individuality through the world of things.
Philip Blom is the author of To Have and To Hold, An Intimate History of Collectors and Collecting. He spoke with Anne Strangechamps. This is a soundscape called House Sounds by the composer Anthea Haddow. It's from Theatre Cryptic's production of Tunnel Visions. Theatre Cryptic's a performing arts company in Glasgow, Scotland. Kathy Boyd's the group's artistic director. Tunnel Visions is a stage production based on the true story of the Collier brothers. Franz Lids is the author of Ghosty Men, the strange but true story of the Collier brothers, New York's greatest hoarders. Homer and Langley Collier lived in Harlem in the early 1900s.
Homer, the older one, was an admiralty lawyer on Wall Street. He used to walk 10 miles every day to Wall Street to his job until he quit one day because they found out that his shoes were not shod properly, and his boss offered to give him a $5 raise, and he never came back and never collected his last check. Langley, the younger brother, was a concert pianist who actually played at Carnegie Hall and quit the concert stage because Paderewski had played and got better notices than he. And he said, why go on? So they lived together in Harlem in this huge brownstone and just shut themselves off from the world with junk that they brought up from the street.
One of the things that I think is so appealing about this story is that they seem to be normal when you're first introduced to them. One was an admiralty lawyer, the other was a concert pianist, their father was a gynecologist, they lived in a lovely brownstone home. But you shortly begin to realize that there was probably something odd about them from very early on, don't you think?
Yes. In fact, they have certain tendencies that their own father had, which was hoarding, and of course, Collier brothers are known as the quintessential hoarders. And neighbors always saw them dragging in things from the street at night. Homer was bedridden for the last decade or so. He had a stroke, and Langley was basically his brother's keeper, dragging in the detritus of the New York streets and really the night. And it was... It was an unusual story even after the Depression when everyone was saving everything because they had money. They had, you know, tens of thousands of dollars in the bank and came from a family with money, but yet they sort of refused to spend any money and had no electricity or water, running water or gas. It was all shut off.
As you write in the book, a journalist named Helen Warden discovered the Collier brothers. She actually interviewed Langley, and Langley didn't see anything odd about her asking him all those questions?
No, he was sort of standoffish. I mean, they valued their privacy, but he was willing to talk to people. No one really ever saw Homer after his stroke. He was kind of flat on his back, and his brother used to feed him 100 oranges a week in this sort of odd attempt to cure his blindness. By the way, it didn't work, but his father being a gynecologist, they knew all about medicine. So,
in fact, didn't he tell another reporter or a bank manager or something that they had 15 shelves of medical books and no, they didn't need any help or something?
Oh, they had thousands of medical books just left over from their father's library. And they considered themselves medical experts who didn't need outside help or electricity or gas or telephones, which was shut up because way back in the 1920s, they'd gotten a long-distance phone bill that they insisted they didn't make, and so they just had the service shut off. Yeah, they were very amiable people, at least Langley was, in his way, and he would sit on the porch for hours talking to neighbors, but he was... Both of them were oblivious to all the changes going on in Harlem.
Did they ever explain, did Langley ever say why he had all of these things in the house, why he kept dragging them back?
Well, I think he just wanted to create his own world of junk. And these were the kind of symbols of civilization. And he could have his own universe in this old mansion without any people in it. So he would—he was basically creating his own little world.
Well, let's go back to the moment. It was 1947. The police got a call that Homer was dead. But they'd had other calls like that before, hadn't they?
Yeah, you know, there'd been so many rumors about the Collier brothers that they were always supposed to be, you know, either dead or fled the country or were hiding in their basement. So, yeah, this is one of many, and this one turned out to be true. Some anonymous caller. What had happened was somebody had noticed that all these cats had been massing on the doorstep that had usually been fed at night by Langley, and they'd been just meowing for days because no one had showed up to feed them. So somebody got the idea to call the police and say maybe one of them is dead, and police broke in.
What did they find when they came into the house? Because they did finally get in looking for Homer, and they found him there.
Yes. They found him actually kind of bent up. He couldn't move. He was paralyzed. And he'd actually starved to death maybe up to 2 weeks earlier. And he was surrounded by a rotting apple and papers from 30 years before. And he was surrounded by literally tunnels of newspapers that went through the house. The whole house was basically these kind of catacombs that were booby-trapped with huge cinder blocks so that no one could ever break in, or if they did try to break in, they would be crushed.
And they found Homer.
They found Homer.
And then there was a worldwide search for Langley. They thought he'd killed his brother or something and run away?
Well, people weren't quite sure what had happened, and there was all kind of speculation about it. And he was sighted on subways, and he was sighted, you know, on trains in North Carolina and in ports of call all over the world. And police checked this stuff out. None of it came out to be true. And then almost 3 weeks after Homer was found, while cleaning out the floor that Homer had been found on, Langley was found buried under a pile of paper, actually 10 feet away. He'd been carrying a tray of food to his older brother and had sprung one of his own booby traps. They found him sort of partially eaten by rats. And all that time that the search had been going on, he was just, you know, only a few yards away.
Well, and they had, I gather, just about everything imaginable inside that house.
Yes, except women, who were never allowed in. It was an all-male club. I think there were some girly posters from the turn of the century, but never women. There were 9 grand pianos. There was a disassembled Model T Ford in the basement and all kinds of antiques that were basically worthless because they're in such a state of disrepair.
And I think I remember reading about a two-headed baby.
A two-headed baby that was seen once but never really turned up in the auctioning process. The two-headed baby was from their father's collection. He was, of course, the gynecologist, and it had been a fetus that was stillborn that he had in a formaldehyde jar.
Franz Liszt is the author of Ghosty Men, the strange but true story of the Collier brothers, New York's greatest hoarders. And this is music from Theater Cryptic's production of Tunnel Visions, a stage production based on the story of the Collier brothers. This is called In Another Time. It's by composer Anthea Haddow. Franz Liszt's book about the Collier brothers also includes another true story about hoarding. This one concerns Liszt's uncle Arthur. His mother called him the lost Collier brother. I asked Franz Liszt if writing this book helped him come to terms with his uncle Arthur's tendency to collect stuff.
It was therapeutic for me in a way, just because I sort of involuntarily found myself going to the dump and throwing things away. I've never really come to terms with Arthur's hoarding habit. As a kid, it used to fascinate me just that he'd created this world of his own, this kind of strange, crowded funhouse. But as an adult, it just seemed sort of creepy, especially the unsanitary side of it. So made me understand it a little better, but I don't know if I've exactly come to terms with it.
Franz Liszt talking about his Uncle Arthur's hoarding habits. This is music from Steve Naive. Coming up, Naive talks about his collection of sounds recorded from hotel room windows around the world as we conclude our look at collectors and collecting. I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. We often ask for your email through our website at ttbook.org. James Flower of California writes, "I'm still seeking a logical distinction between creating terror on the orders of one's government and creating terror for one's own political purposes." Also about John Brown, Chris, who signs himself a Six Sigma Black Belt, writes, "I'm highly troubled by the term terrorist being applied to anyone who objects to the status quo." You can send us email at ttbook.org. We're going to conclude our hour on collecting with a profile of a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Steve Naive. Naive is best known for his work as the keyboard player for Elvis Costello's longtime backing band, The Attractions. That's how Naive ended up in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He and Costello also often perform live as a duo. But there's much more to Steve Naive than his work with Elvis Costello. As to the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon discovered when he caught up with Naive backstage in Chicago. For example, Steve Naive's latest solo album, Windows. It's a collection of songs based on Naive's collection of sounds.
The idea of the album was that it would open the window of whatever place I was in and take some sound out of that window and try to weave this into a musical piece. And so you go on a sort of journey around the world when you listen to the album.
What inspired you to record sounds out of the various hotel rooms when you're on tour, and also you take photos as well? Yeah. Can you tell me how you got started doing that?
I'm not exactly sure when I started doing that, but I started to notice that taking a photo of a window nearly always produces an interesting photo, something about the light coming through into a dark room. And so that got me started on the thing. And then I've always carried some sort of DAT or something with me to record ambient sound. And so I just put the two things together.
One of the tracks, Window Number 3, Declan's Window, it's music, but you've also incorporated some of the street sound.
Yeah.
Could you tell me about Window Number 3?
Yeah. Well, on a lot of the windows, I didn't just stick to recording putting the mic out the window. I actually ventured out into the jungle and recorded some sounds. Window Number 3 is obviously, when you hear it, New York. And, you know, that sound of police sirens is so New York. Actually, I was in a taxi cab when I recorded that, so we were kind of flying around blocks and the sound of the siren was disappearing and then coming back. And then I looped it. It's a good maybe a minute and a half, the recording, but it goes around a couple of times. And then I started adding the theme to it, which I played on the clarinet, I think.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. You don't just play the keyboard. Do you play that often? That's the first time I've heard you play it.
Well, that's the first time I've ever put it on a recording. I go on and off it. I can't pretend to be a great clarinetist, but I can get a few notes out of it. I love playing it.
And I've got to ask you what is probably a silly question, but of course Elvis Costello's real name is Declan Patrick McManus, and this song is called Window Number 3, Declan's Window. Is there any significance to that?
Originally I was just going to call it Window Number 1, 2, Number 3, but then I decided to give certain windows specific names because Declan has just relocated to New York. It seemed like a good idea to make that Declan's Window, you know. I presume that's the kind of sound that he's going to be hearing quite a lot when he opens his window, you know. Yeah.
I want to ask you about your previous album, which came out in 2002. It's called Moo Moo.
I wish I could cry like the young people. I'm okay to lie with the young people. Give anything a try like the young people do today. I wanna speak in reverse like the young people. So I might be for later. You gotta stop being my young people.
Oh, this album was quite a departure for you because you actually sing on this album. You sound really good. Why did you decide to sing on Mumu?
Well, I've written a lot of songs. For the most part, they sort of remain inside my computer or my notebooks and no one's heard them. So I haven't so far been very successful in persuading someone else to do them. I decided in the end that the best thing was just to go for it. I was fortunate to find a record company in Paris that were prepared to do that. I'm hoping to make Mumu 2 later this year. Everything's written. I've just got to find the time to do it in between the things I do with Elvis and things like that.
I'm confident again in Muriel's mission control. Circles like a tongue around an ice cream cone, waiting for permission to land.
I understand that your wife, the French playwright Muriel Teodori, tried to talk you out of singing on this album. Can you tell me about that?
Well, she wasn't exactly talking me out of singing, but I did go through a process of recording demos of the songs and playing them to her, and she was very critical, and that was very helpful. And she actually taught me a lot about what was wrong with my voice. And even now that I've got some new songs I want to do, I think I will have to go through that process again, because, you know, when you hear a really great singer like Elvis, or someone like Elvis who puts a lot of emotion and feeling into the song that they're singing, that's fantastic. But when someone like me does that, that's a disaster. And so the only way that I can sing a song is if I can find a way of doing it without putting any feeling like that into the voice, which is quite difficult to do. And it's sort of a process that takes time to become sort of cold. And then the voice is acceptable. You can listen to it, yeah, even though I can't sing.
Oh, I would dispute that. I would dispute that.
You need protection from the physical out of conversation. Though the fist is mightier than the lip, it's got the aggravation. I got the best one. I got persuasion, a proposition for invasion of your privacy. Put yourself away and find the fake in me. You'll never be a man, no matter how many foreign bodies you can take. You'll never be a man.
I want to ask you a few questions about your musical partnership with Elvis Costello. It goes back a long way to the late 1970s, when you were a member of his backing band, The Attractions, to your current role providing keyboard accompaniment. Steve, how does your role change when it's just you and Elvis on stage, as opposed to you and the other Attractions, Pete and Bruce, playing with Elvis?
Well, it changes in so much as the music is a little freer, and so dynamically things can change from line to line, you know. And so there's a lot of listening going on, which maybe isn't so critical when you're playing with a band and there's an arrangement and that's how it goes. And I suppose the other thing is the arrangement is something that isn't set in concrete, so you can suddenly decide to go on a different instrument or whatever. Also, I think that there's more freedom in the set, because it's possible to go into any kind of songs whenever Elvis feels like it, which is maybe a little more difficult to do when you've got three or four other guys to think about.
It's interesting to hear how different some of the songs sound when it is just you and Elvis playing them. For example, one song in particular, Temptation, from the Get Happy album.
Who's this kid with his mumbo jumbo living in air conditioned limbo? Though they treat him just like a guest, he's living under threat of arrest. Now that he's finally trying to make some sense, he drinks in self-defense. Give me temptation.
You came up with a very different arrangement for just you and Elvis to play. How did you come up with that arrangement? It's a great arrangement, by the way.
Well, I think it was might have been a little bit inspired by Eric Satie. Quite often I sit at home and just play through the songs by myself, and I find ways to play them that are nothing like we normally do, you know. And that was just one that he liked it a lot.
Give me temptation. Give me temptation.
It's the Steve Naive with the piano there. Yeah.
Musician Steve Naive. He spoke with, to the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon. And here is more of Steve Naive's music. This is Window Number 6, Mercedes Window. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like a cassette copy of this hour, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. And ask for program number 12B, Collecting. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website. It's at www.ttbook.org. It's always nice to hear from you. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Steve Paulson, Mary Lou Finnegan, Anne Strange Champs, Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, and Veronica Rickard, with engineering help from Marv Nunn and Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.